This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, June 27th. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A successful campaign to end bilingual education in California and Arizona sets its sights on Colorado.
There's a huge misperception among the public, and one that Mr. Unz likes to push, that children aren't learning English in these programs, and that couldn't be further from the truth. That is one of the main aims of bilingual education.
A Mexican on death row in Oklahoma may get his sentence changed to life in prison. And could global warming eventually dry up the world's water resources? California isn't taking any chances. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Rewarding Yugoslavia for pursuing their extradition of former President Slobodan Milosevic, the United States has agreed to attend an international conference on financial aid for the Balkan country. The U.S. has been putting considerable pressure on Yugoslavia to make sure Milosevic goes to the tribunal in The Hague to face indictments of crimes against humanity. Today, the World Court said the United States violated international law by denying two executed Germans their right to consulate. The court also criticized the Arizona court for ignoring their order to delay the execution of one of the two brothers. The United States apologized to Germany for their error, but said the brothers got a fair trial. Verdicts by the World Court are binding with no appeal, but the organization has no way to enforce their rulings. As Pakistani and Indian leaders ready for their summit, residents of Kashmir think most of the talk is just that, and are looking for a real peace. On the Sachin Glacier, the world's highest battleground, the two countries have been fighting over Kashmir since 1984. Free Speech Radio News correspondent James Smoot reports from Kashmir.
Pervez Musharraf's assumption to the presidency in Pakistan has caused hardly a ripple of comment in Kashmir. Most Kashmiris just want the violence to end, and they don't care who ends it. While pundits in Delhi are cynical about any positive outcome from the July 15th India-Pakistan summit, Kashmiris are cautiously optimistic, and perhaps they have reason to be so. Musharraf has said he will come to the talks in Agra with an open mind. Leaks from Islamabad indicate Musharraf will make radical proposals that will drop almost all territorial claims on the Indian side of the line of control. Musharraf's ongoing campaign to disarm Islamic militants in Pakistan has also been taken as a positive sign in Kashmir. But in the run-up to the summit, violence is escalating. Peace is nowhere near at hand. For Free Speech Radio News, this is James Smoot in Kashmir.
The two largest farm workers' unions sued the U.S. Labor Department, saying it is illegally failing to raise wages. Valdemar Velasquez, president of the Farm Labor Organizing Committee, discusses why they are part of the suit.
There's no fields out there that have time clocks. Who's keeping the hours of the workers? So what they end up doing is just paying them the piece rate. We want them to not only set a higher minimum wage, we want them to effectively enforce that. Because when the standard is set in the books legally, then we can go to and pressure the employers to make sure that they pay that higher minimum wage.
A Labor Department spokesperson says Secretary Chao only has to set the new wage rate sometime during the calendar year. Union representatives say waiting until December would deny the raise to workers this season. Democratic legislators in the Oregon State House of Representatives are refusing to work. Denise Kowalczyk reports from Portland, Oregon.
Oregon House Democrats continued their boycott over legislative redistricting. The boycott began Monday, and House Minority Leader Dan Gardner says the Democrats will not return until Republicans abandon their maneuver to push through a redistricting plan that was written so it would bypass the state's governor. The issue of redistricting is a hot one because it may determine party strength for the next 10 years. Members of the GOP expressed a willingness to negotiate, but Democrats say they are prepared to continue the boycott until the redistricting deadline on Sunday. However, if no plan is passed by Saturday, the Oregon State Constitution gives the job of drawing new legislative districts to adjust for population changes to Secretary of State Bill Bradbury, a Democrat. From Portland, Oregon, I'm Denise Kowalczyk.
And finally, a new report says more government workers may have been contaminated and by higher dosages of uranium and plutonium than originally estimated. Ellen Ratner has the story from D.C.
According to a U.S. nuclear weapons report, a uranium recycling program was found to have twice as much tainted uranium than was previously thought. From 1952 to 1999, workers were exposed to higher amounts of radiation after coming into contact with 250,000 tons of uranium tainted with plutonium. Alan Muller, executive director of Green Delaware, believes the government needs to step in.
Many of these people are now elderly, and they have cancer and other diseases that result from their employment, and certainly the federal government should accept some responsibility for it.
The discovery of the increased amount of tainted uranium dramatically increases the possibility of soil and groundwater pollution. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio, I'm Ellen Ratner.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
After success in passing ballot initiatives to end bilingual education in California and Arizona, Ron Unz, a software developer from the Silicon Valley, is focusing his sights on Colorado. Unz spent $750,000 backing Proposition 227 in California, the English language in public schools measure, and plans to provide financial support for a similar initiative in Colorado. With the stated aim of helping immigrant children learn English more quickly, the initiative would end bilingual education and institute a one-year English immersion program, after which children would be placed in monolingual, in other words, English-only classrooms. The campaign follows a fourfold increase in the number of limited English proficient students eligible for bilingual education in Colorado between 1981 and 1996. English for the Children of Colorado, which is affiliated with UNS's California-based organization and headed up by a former Denver School Board member, announced it was filing the initiative with the Legislative Council last Tuesday. Neil Geiser reports.
Silicon Valley millionaire Ron Unz decided to bankroll a Colorado anti-bilingual education campaign after local activists asked him to help them get an initiative on the ballot. Bilingual education teaches children in their primary language as well as English until they become proficient in English. Unz says that he remains committed to eliminating bilingual education, a teaching method he says is clearly a failure because Latino immigrants, the very population it focuses on, do the worst on tests and other measures of scholastic success.
Even though bilingual programs are allegedly beneficial, the one group of immigrant students that actually receives these allegedly beneficial bilingual programs is the one immigrant group that does the worst in school, with the highest dropout rates and the lowest test scores and the lowest rate of admission to college. And I think that would make people pretty skeptical of whether bilingual education is beneficial or actually harmful.
There's a huge misperception among the public, and one that Mr. Unz likes to push, that children aren't learning English in these programs, and that couldn't be further from the truth. That is one of the main aims of bilingual education, is to teach children English. But bilingual education allows children to learn English while they're continuing to learn math and reading and all the other subjects other kids learn.
Delia Pompa is the executive director of the National Association for Bilingual Education, based in Washington, D.C. Proponents of bilingual education say that the initiative is an attack on a program that has been proven to be effective in helping children learn English while maintaining their academic skills. In order to combat the hundreds of thousands of dollars Unz may spend on the campaign in Colorado, critics of the initiative are already organizing to defeat it at the polls. Nancy Cummins is a consultant who helps schools design bilingual education programs in Colorado.
Already in Colorado, people from around the state have organized together to talk about how we're going to work together as a coherent group to get the message out that parents want their children to receive a quality education, that we need quality programs to teach English to our children, but that parents should have choice and that local control should still remain in effect in Colorado so that each district can remain accountable to the state through programs of their own design.
Unz says that in California, test scores for English learners have shot up since his amendment passed 3 years ago. But James Crawford, an independent researcher who focuses on language and education issues and has written several books examining bilingual education, suggests that Unz and his allies are pushing the initiative for political reasons, not out of real concern for the fate of immigrant children.
If Ron Unz really cared about the interest of immigrant children, he would have done some research into how bilingual education works. He would have visited bilingual programs. He would have read what academic authorities have to say about the program. And he would have discovered that bilingual education is quite effective in teaching English. But in fact, he did not do any of those things. I think he's basically approaching this for political reasons. He essentially is trying to rally support from people who are worried about the assimilation of immigrants. And I don't think that's a productive starting point for people who are trying to improve schools for immigrant children.
Unz has already run two unsuccessful campaigns for public office, failing to make it past the Republican primaries in both the California gubernatorial and senatorial races. Regardless, he sees the Colorado initiative as another stepping stone towards a national rollback of bilingual education. He points to a possible ballot initiative in Massachusetts and a lawsuit to end bilingual education in New York City as his next targets. English for the Children of Colorado must gather 80,571 signatures to put the issue on the November 2002 ballot. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Geiser in Boulder, Colorado.
The governor of Oklahoma is considering commuting the sentence of a convicted murderer to life in prison without parole. Governor Keating already stayed the execution of Gerardo Valdez, a Mexican national, for 30 days after Mexican President Vicente Fox personally appealed to him to halt the execution. Rennie McKay has more about the decision the Oklahoma governor has to make.
In 1989, Geraldo Valdez shot Juan Barone twice in the head, slit his throat, and then burned him in a barbecue pit. He says he did this because Barone made a homosexual advance toward him. He was set to die on June 19th, but several factors led Oklahoma Republican Governor Frank Keating to stay the execution and take a closer look at the case. Dan Mahoney is the governor's spokesman.
In this case, Mr. Valdez is obviously guilty. No one is even disputing that. The issue in this case is the Vienna Convention, and that apparently Mr. Valdez, who was a Mexican national, was not given the opportunity to communicate with the Mexican consulate as allowed by the Vienna Convention. Is that enough to actually postpone the execution? Is that enough to come up with a failure of due process for Mr. Valdez?
The Mexican government says it is. Miguel Monterrubio handles media relations for the Mexican embassy in Washington. He says international law goes further than just allowing Valdez to contact the Mexican consulate.
The international law, the Article 36 of the Consular Convention, requires countries to inform the country that the national is that they have been they have arrested one person. And we have never been notified until 10 years after he was sentenced to death.
Monterrubio also says if the Mexican government had been informed, Valdez wouldn't have received the death penalty because they would have helped his defense. Now they're pushing to have that sentence commuted and say they hope Governor Keating will follow the advice of the Oklahoma Pardon and Parole Board, which voted 3-1 to commute Valdez's sentence to life in prison without parole. This is only the second time in 35 years they've made that recommendation, but Governor Keating is not bound to follow their directives. And this wouldn't be the first time a foreign national has been executed in the U.S. without contacting their consulates. Dan Mahoney says Governor Keating has considered the previous cases.
As a matter of fact, there is also a Supreme Court precedent for allowing executions to go forward under this scenario. And Governor Bush, at the time, did allow an execution to go forward. So I think legal precedent is there. The governor has to look at the case and determine whether he feels comfortable and whether that was just a legal technicality or whether it was indeed a violation of due process.
In June of 1999, then-Texas Governor George W. Bush oversaw the execution of Canadian Stanley Fulder, and last November, Bush signed the death warrant for Mexican Miguel Flores. Monterrubio says President Fox respects Oklahoma law, even though the government of Mexico has condemned countries with the death penalty, and says Fox didn't get involved in this case as a protest of the death penalty.
I think it's important because there's the life of a Mexican involved, and that's why we are doing several things to try to save his life.
There is no new scheduled date for an execution of Valdez. On July 18th, the Attorney General of Oklahoma can ask the courts to set a new date. But whatever Governor Keating decides, Valdez must at least serve life in prison in Oklahoma for his savage act. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rennie McKay.
Scientists are in general agreement that the world's temperature is increasing, probably by as much as 3 to 6 degrees Celsius by the year 2060. That could have serious implications for water resources nationwide. In California, the State Department of Water Resources has begun to look at what global warming will mean for the state's water supply. Robin Yurovich reports.
Global warming will have some very concrete implications for the nation's water supply. And for the first time in California, the state government is starting to plan for it.
The argument is not, is climate change going to happen?
Hydrologist Peter Glick of Oakland's Pacific Institute is the lead author of a study on the impact of climate change on national water resources.
The argument has become, how bad will it be and what are the details of the impacts and what's it going to cost to do something about it?
The California Department of Water Resources has begun to take global warming into account as it updates its five-year water plan. It's a big step, Glick says, taking global warming out of the theoretical sphere and into the maps and plans of a local government agency.
Some climate change is irreversible, and therefore I better be doing things now, or we the state better be doing things now, or we the nation better be doing things now to reduce the worst impacts and to prevent the bad things that are probably going to happen.
There are a number of bad things that could happen. Nationwide, snow will melt at lower elevations, and rain will increasingly replace mountain snows. An expected rise in sea level could damage coastal aquifers from Hawaii to Nantucket Island. In California, the snowpack supplies much of the water supply, and the state could be in for water shortages and severe lowland flooding. And, says Ron Gastelum, the CEO of Southern California's Metropolitan Water District, the purity of the state's water could be affected as well.
If there is massive flooding in the Delta and the levees that currently exist there are washed out, if there is a rise in the seawater elevation and you have saltwater infiltration, it could have a dramatic impact on the quality of the water that we import from the Delta.
Part of the answer to some of California's future water needs could be found in facilities like this one. Santa Monica's Urban Runoff Recycling Facility, or SMRF as it's known here. It's the first facility in the country that recycles stormwater for irrigation and other non-potable purposes. Santa Monica's manager of public works, Craig Perkins, says although recycling here is still on a small scale, plants like this have the potential to serve 30 to 40% of California's water needs.
On a year-round basis, what we assume will be used from users of this plant is about 300,000 gallons of water per day. So that's 300,000 gallons of potable water per day that we will not have to import from Northern California or the Colorado River.
This plant also keeps polluted storm runoff out of Santa Monica Bay. It came with a steep price tag. It cost $11 million to build. Cost is one factor that may have kept other cities from embarking on similar projects. But Perkins says as water shortages become more severe, the cost of water from conventional sources will rise. As California begins to consider solutions to a potential water crisis, the sharpest disagreements may be over what changes need to be made. The battle is likely to shape up between those who say more conservation is the answer and others who'd advocate more dams, aqueducts, and reservoirs. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Robin Yurovich in Los Angeles.
As debate rages over the drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, the oil industry has quietly gained a foothold in another environmental sensitive area of Arctic Alaska. Since 1999, the federal government has permitted oil companies to proceed with offshore exploration and development in the Arctic Ocean. And as Norm Goldstein reports today from Barrow, Alaska, this growing offshore presence has many local residents very concerned.
For more than 1,000 years, the Inupiat people of the Alaskan Arctic have hunted the bowhead whale. Before the days of grocery stores and modern houses, the whale hunt provided the Inupiat with the food and fuel they needed for survival. Today, it provides them their spiritual and cultural identity as well. But these days, many Inupiat fear that the traditional whale hunt is in jeopardy.
If we don't have a whale, we don't get a Christmas. We don't have a Thanksgiving. That's how important whale is to the Inupiat people.
That's Ronald Brower Sr. speaking at a public hearing held in Barrow, Alaska by the U.S. Minerals Management Service. Since 1979, the MMS has sold more than 5.5 million acres of oil and gas leases in the Arctic Ocean off the northern Alaska coast. 2 years ago, the oil industry began to develop some of those leases. Since that offshore development lies directly in the migratory path of the bowhead whale, local residents are growing more and more concerned about the possibility of an oil spill there. Specifically, they worry that the undersea pipelines carrying oil back to shore could be ruptured by the large icebergs that float through the Arctic Ocean much of the year. Throughout the many MMS hearings held over the past 5 years, Inupiat elders have repeatedly testified to the awesome power of the sea ice. One of those is Rossman Pituk, a whaling captain from the village of Wainwright.
When you have ocean currents and the wind and a rise in the water table happening at the same time, very large icebergs get moved against the ocean floor as if they were big bulldozers. Because I have seen this kind of phenomena happen more than once in my life, it makes me fearful of what might happen if there is a pipeline placed even beneath the bottom of the ocean floor.
Pituk's observations are based on more than 50 years' experience hunting on the Arctic ice pack. His observations differ markedly from those of the oil companies and their engineers, whose statistics and computer models indicate a low risk of an oil spill. That's what Peter Hanley of British Petroleum said during a public hearing on the oil company's offshore North Star project.
While we can never guarantee there will not be a spill, we can assure you that every prevention measure will be in place and the necessary response equipment will be available. The pipeline design is very conservative and robust, recognizing the special environmental conditions found in this part of the Beaufort Sea. The offshore pipelines are buried over 3 times deeper than the deepest observed ice gouge.
Most of the federal oversight agencies apparently agree with the oil company's assessment of the risk. In its final environmental impact statement for the North Star project, the Army Corps of Engineers estimated the probability of a major oil spill at around 12%. The numbers are even better for British Petroleum's latest offshore project, known as Liberty. The draft EIS for the Liberty project puts the risk of an oil spill at around 6%. But those numbers do not reassure barrel whaling captain Arnold Brower Jr.
I just watched a NBA ball game today saying the same numbers. This man has a 85% efficiency to make his free throws, and in my very eyes, right there, he missed. Now that's the efficiency you're talking about. When does that 5% happen? Do you know? Can you tell me that?
Adding to concerns is the belief that the oil industry could not clean up a spill in the broken ice of the Arctic Ocean. That belief stems from a series of drills run by BP last year in which the oil company tested its spill response plan for North Star. Bill Tagosiak is with the Inupiat community of the Arctic Slope, the regional tribal government.
On 3 different occasions, oil industry proved that they did not have a cleanup contingency plan in the event of a major oil spill. 3 different times, the only thing they did to show that they have a cleanup plan was pick up popcorn off the ocean. But popcorn doesn't replace oil as it floats through water, so, you know, there is no cleanup plan.
BP has acknowledged the flaws in its cleanup plan, but it still intends to begin production at North Star in November. However, the state of Alaska has told the oil company it will have to shut down operations during those times of year when broken ice is present. In the meantime, BP is forging ahead with plans for its Liberty project. The final environmental impact statement for Liberty is due out this fall, and construction is expected to begin sometime next year. From Barrow, Alaska, for Free Speech Radio News, this is Norm Goldstein.
In the war-torn African country of Burundi, journalists find one of the weariest battles of all is the fight for freedom of the press and the struggle to disseminate truth about politically sensitive topics. In this report, Free Speech Radio News correspondent Rupert Cook looks into the perils and the politics of being a journalist in Burundi.
The sounds of the Burundian Congolese band, Orchestra d'Or, making their contribution to Burundi's battle against the ravages of malaria through an educational song broadcast on national radio about how to prevent the disease. Burundi is a country racked by civil war, disease, and grinding poverty.
despite the almost decade-long civil war between the Tutsi-dominated government forces and the mainly Hutu rebels. There is a range of different media in the capital, Bujumbura, both print and radio, some thriving, most just surviving. For Burundian journalists, the broadcasting of public service health announcements or educational songs from the likes of Orchestra d'Or poses little problem. However, the situation changes when the subject becomes a more sensitive issue. Willy Nindorera is a journalist with independent broadcaster Studio Ijambo in Bujumbura.
Le contexte légal et réglementaire.
The legal and regulatory context is still fairly restrictive. I mean, there is a law on the press, which has a certain number of clauses which are designed to destroy press freedom. So journalists have to work within the constraints of the law. The second thing is that we are a country at war, and there are obviously events and things that are difficult to cover. And when you cover them, they can be difficult to report. We regularly have tension between the authorities and the press.
Although censorship and harassment most frequently come from the organs of the state, another challenge facing Burundi's media is the problem of objectivity in a particularly divided society. Rwanda's genocide of 1994, in which more than 1 million, mainly Tutsis and moderate Hutus, were killed by army and militia loyal to the then Hutu extremist government, hangs like a spectral shadow over Burundi's future. In Rwanda, journalists played a major role in inciting the genocide, with some radio stations advocating and celebrating the policy of ethnic extermination. There is anxiety that such partisan propaganda could be repeated in Burundi. Francis Rolt works for NGO Search for Common Ground in Bujumbura.
Oh, it's very definitely a problem. Individuals in the state radio will take very strong lines in the kind of interviews that they do, the way they approach those interviews. Individual journalists are known to be supporters of pretty extreme movements. There was one journalist in a meeting recently, a meeting called by one of the leaders of one of the more right-wing groups here, and the journalist who had been sent by the state radio to cover this event said off his own bat, not as a journalist, but apparently as part of the meeting, he said the time has come to target the families of those politicians who are attending the peace negotiations in Arusha. That was a journalist saying that.
For the majority of Burundian journalists who seek to report on what is actually happening in their country, the risks can be considerable. Agnes Nindorera is a correspondent for German National Radio in Bujumbura. She has received international awards for her courage in reporting.
Firstly, I was investigated. It was a humiliation for me because I didn't consider myself a criminal. But I saw a detachment of soldiers arrive at my house at 5 in the morning. It wasn't very pleasant. I spent the whole day with the police, and they released me later. They seized all my equipment and only returned it a week later. Sometimes I've been beaten by soldiers with the butts of their rifles, because everyone thinks that a journalist is an insignificant nobody who can be mistreated any way you like.
Despite the risks and difficulties faced by Burundian journalists, there is hope that their active and independent reporting can make a major contribution to the country's attempts to promote peace, or at least reduce ethnic tension. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rupert Cook, in Bujumbura, Burundi.
This newscast was produced at WMNF Radio in Tampa and the Independent Media Center in New York. I'm Verna Avery Brown.